Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What does it mean to be English? Is it cups of milky tea, barbecues spoiled by rain, collective memories of Euro 96? Or is it something less ephemeral, a tradition, a way of life, a state of mind? Recently, there's been a battle over what the symbols of Englishness, like the flag, represent and to whom. On St. George's Day, no less, I was joined by author and journalist Tom Baldwin and academic Mark Steers, who argue that Englishness is a collection of stories we tell ourselves. Discuss how they've been appropriated for political ends, and if Keir Starmer can be the one to reclaim them. Enjoy.
Am I tough enough? Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one!
It's the Politics Show cast.
Before we get into it, chaps, how would you like to introduce yourselves? Tom, you want to go first?
I'm a sort of recovering journalist who I worked at the Times for a long time. Then I went to work for Ed Miliband when he was Labour leader, director of communications for four and a half years. Then we lost, and I went off to help run the campaign for a second referendum on Europe, which we also lost. So I'm basically, you know, naught for two in terms
of
campaigns.
You're a victor,
campaigns. Yeah. I've just written what I'm calling the authoritative, not authorised biography of Keir Starmer, at the same time as I was writing England. And there is a kind of continuity between them that we might get onto later. But I suppose now I'm a writer.
Mm. Okay, nice.
Yeah. Not a bad thing to be.
Absolutely not, no. Mark?
So I was a university academic for most of my adult life. So I taught politics at Oxford.
Teach anyone interesting?
Liz Truss was probably my, you know, sort of, I wouldn't say best student, but definitely most famous student.
Okay.
I was at Oxford for a long time doing that. And then when Ed Miliband became leader of the Labour Party, I went to work with Ed and I shared an office with Tom Baldwin. And we locked the doors and turned the lights off for many of the days.
That sounds almost dirty, Mark.
We couldn't win the election. We were too busy shagging. Yeah, it's nice.
The lights were dim as we were working.
Okay, got it.
And then after we lost the election, I kind of went into think tanks for a bit. Then I went to Australia, ran a think tank in Australia, and have recently come back to launch a think tank at University College London.
Okay, brilliant. So, like I said, this conversation is about myth. It's about England, English identity, nationalism. And like I said, for those, the title of the book, England: Seven Myths That Changed the Country and How to Set Them Straight. So we recently saw a conservative campaign ad, which has since been deleted from Twitter/X. And it claimed that Britain was the second most powerful country in the world. However, that claim about Britain was illustrated by a picture of the men's England team, the King, an Aston Martin, and a Typhoon aircraft. So I guess the question then is, where do we get this kind of conflation, right, of Britain and England? How do those two things mesh? And I'm sort of driving at, there's a quote in the book, I think it's near the beginning, that England is kind of a country that doesn't really exist. Is it that sort of relationship between England and Britain that leads to that? Where do we get this kind of conflation of the two?
I think that part of the problem has been that, you know, there is a real England. You know, there's not a kind of England in a legal sense. You know, it's a country without borders. You don't have an English passport. There's, you know, there's an English football team. That's about it. But this real England has become very, very distorted by the politicisation of different myths about it. We've seen, you know, that, you know, every country has stories, and stories matter. But stories about, you know, Magna Carta or Francis Drake and the Armada, they become, we invented liberty and we don't need to learn anything from continental Europe, or we once ruled the waves and global Britain can once again find its destiny out on the silver sea. It's nonsense, and it's got in the way of making progress. It's got in the way of finding a way for us all to live together. And what this book tries to do is just to very gently bring these myths down to earth, back down to the real England, the level of people, so that we can begin to find a way forward, sometimes using these stories.
Mm. Oh, what do you think?
Yeah, I think we've, you know, in the sort of last 20 years or so, I guess, I think we've seen what I always think of as a kind of increasingly angry conversation about England, which, as you were just saying, has often like pitched it against the idea of Britain in a way which would have seemed, well, really weird when I was a kid. You know, so when we were working for Ed Miliband, there were posters the Tories put up of Alex Salmond, the Scottish national leader, with a little Ed Miliband in his top pocket. And the idea of being like, yeah, Scotland was somehow dominating England because you didn't have a strong enough, you know, sort of English Labour Party leader. And that sort of rivalry between England and the rest of the country kind of echoes what Tom's just been describing, a kind of rivalry between England and the rest of the world. So it's you take this notion of the country, a kind of weird country, a country that doesn't really exist, and you inflate it for political purposes in order to have a row. And that's really why we wrote the book, because we wanted to say, well, oh, hold on a minute, that's not the England that we recognise. It's not the England we think most people talk about when they think about it. So, like, how can you stop it being this sort of tool of political populism and make it something else again?
I think this is the tension that I really want to, well, we will inevitably sort of explore over the course of this conversation, which is simultaneously the line that you had there, Tom. You said stories do matter, right? Simultaneously, we're talking about the kind of corrosive slash nefarious effect of myth. And I think the thing that possibly concerns me in the idea of deflating, bringing them down, finding the muddle, is that it possibly overlooks, okay, yes, myth is myth. It's not real. You know, whether take your pick, whatever it is, we will get into the detail of them, right? They're possibly ahistorical. But at the end of the day, if that narrative serves a purpose, i.e., it might be something as sort of cynical as putting your political party of choice in parliament. It might also be something as existential as mobilizing a nation to defend itself in a time of war. Whether or not it's true, whether or not it's real, perhaps risks losing the intended purpose of it, that it can be used to motivate people to do extraordinary things, and that actually that's the power of the myth, right? It's not, is it real, is it not? It's what it causes people to do in the name of it.
Yeah, but see, I think there is this real England, and it doesn't have to be mythology. It can just be this sense of the muddle, a sense of a rather sort of amazing place, you know, not necessarily better than anywhere else, but, you know, it's the difference between sort of patriotism and nationalism. You can love your country without saying it's better than anywhere else. And I think, you know, I think you saw during the pandemic, the way people came together, you know, hundreds of thousands of people volunteering for the NHS, and also the way we rolled out the vaccine. It wasn't anything to do with Boris Johnson or some sort of really expensive app in which he spaffed off like £6 billion. It was actually through very dowdy NHS centres, GP surgeries, where people sort of understood they had to wait their turn. It was fair. It was everyone's going to get it, but it was going to be done in a fair way. And that felt much more like England to me than these ideas of national greatness, or we ran the best empire, or we're going to be world beaters, everything. It was humble. It was gentle. It allowed difference. It felt like the place that I love.
Mm. And I remember the first guy, right, who gets the vaccine. It's William Shakespeare, isn't it?
His second one.
Second one. So there's already that eye maybe on the story and how something is told, right, in that decision. Okay, so that, Mark, on the one hand, we've got that that vision of England. To is that Scruton, I think, Visions of England, maybe? that Tom has just put out there. And possibly set oppositionally against the one which I was just describing there about sort of typhoons and the England football team and that sort of thing. So, I mean, in opposition to what Tom's just said there, what is that England, right, that perhaps other political forces like the Conservative Party are trying to invoke? Can you try and set some parameters to define that, that version of England for
yeah,
us?
Yeah, look, I think what the, you know, the rivals to our position essentially want inflation. So they want to pump things up. They want to make things grand. They're often either cliches or abstractions. You know, the English invented liberty. The English Empire or the British Empire was better than all the rest because it was moral and ethical in a way. So, you know, we brought railways to India or whatever it might be. I think probably at its heart, it's got two things wrong with it, that version of England. The first is it's just kind of ridiculous. And most people instinctively know that it's ridiculous. And it's often written by people who have very little contact with ordinary life or, you know, sort of daily business.
Like who, the reason are, that, who are ridiculous.
Yeah, who are ridiculous. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like politicians, I think, often get patriotism or storytelling about country wrong because they're not really living in the same kind of everyday world that the rest of us are. And so they end up using kind of politicized language, which is empty and abstract and meaningless, and people roll their eyes at it. So I think and that's what happened with that tweet from the party that you described. I think the second thing about it, though, is it is written with a purpose which isn't it doesn't even have to be full-blown truthfulness, you know, but it's intended to distort, to manipulate, to control, to get people to think and do something, not in the interests of the country as a whole, but in the interests of the storyteller. So, you know, in the tweet example, which is such a great one, you know, what's it meant to do? It's meant to show that that everything is brilliant here. You know, Britain's the second most powerful country in the world. Therefore, we don't have to criticize the government. You don't have to worry about cost of living crisis. Don't have to worry about climate. You know, it's everything is great. And that's just a political purpose dressed up as a story about the country. So I think what we're trying to do in the book is say those are the two things wrong with the way that political people often talk about the country. You know, on the one hand, it's just kind of ridiculous. On the second hand, it's self-serving and it's not a picture of the people who actually live here.
I'd sort of put that answer then back to you in relation to the actual exercise of busting the myths, right? If a lot of people recognise that those ideas are ridiculous, I don't know, and in terms of the specific myths, maybe not so much, but for example, Francis Drake, right? I think a fair few people do know him to be a pirate, right? Or, I don't know, that Magna Carta is essentially an agreement between a baron and a king and not this sort of like foundational and you know, no man shall infringe upon the liberty of an Englishman or what the sort of the idea of it that gets espoused in kind of slightly kooky anti-COVID Facebook groups and things like that, right? So if that is the case, and most people do know these things to be myths, what is the outcome or intended purpose of sort of going through them in the way that you have done in the book?
I mean, I think it's largely because politics has become a battleground of these inflated myths, even at the same time as ordinary people, normal people know that they're bonkers. And what we're trying to say in the book is that look, that's not doing our country any good. If our public debate, our public discussion, be it social media or, you know, debates and discussions like this or, you know, sort of campaign leaflets are full only of these kind of crazy stories about the country, then it's no surprise that our politics both isn't respected by people because they're telling stories about the country which aren't true, but also becomes angrier and more polarized as kind of people bash each other with these, you know, overly inflated, grandiose stories. So I think at least one of the things we're trying to do in the book is say, look, it's really important to have a conversation about the past of our country, what we did well and what we did badly. It's also even more important to have a discussion about the future. What kind of country should we try and become? But at the moment, our politics doesn't have that in a kind of real or subtle or nuanced or textured way. It has it through these sort of cartoonish sort of absurdities. So, like, just stop doing that and we might be able to make some progress.
Tom, do you agree that sort of national politics is far removed from the experience of everyday Britons? And I'm coming at that consciously as well from your position in relation to Keir Starmer, the book you've just written about him and him having been the Labour Party leader now for going on 4 years?
Yeah. I think one of the sort of paradoxes of politics today is every poll I read says that people really hate politicians. And yet everyone I meet in politics wrings their hands and says, oh my God, I wish Keir Starmer could be more like a politician. And, you know, the truth is he's not really very political in the sort of capital P sense. He doesn't really like politics. He didn't spend sort of his childhood posing naked in front of a mirror practicing his party conference speech in 2024. You know, he came to politics.
Is that what the rest of them do?
I've never been there, but you know, there is a sense that, you know, some people have spent their whole life wanting to be there, and he certainly didn't. And he's looking around and saying, this is quite weird politics. You know, he is quite, you know, in political terms, he's extraordinarily ordinary. And quite English. You know, he likes going to the pub. Other politicians go to the pub and they go straight behind the bar and pour a pint badly and pose at the cameras. He melts into the background with the other middle-aged men better than any politician I've ever seen, including Nigel Farage. Right? You know, he likes football. He actually quite likes people in a way that lots of politicians don't. And so I think there's this sense about trying to reconnect our politics to earth it. You know, like, you know, you have this sort of grandiosity of myths. Like, you know, the idea, you know, quite a great story about how England or Britain stood alone in the Second World War against Nazi Germany. And that's a great story to find. So it sort of ignores the contribution of the Empire and lots of other people around
Polish
the world.
Polish fighter pilots, yeah.
But, yeah. But it did get us through some very difficult times. But then it becomes puffed up and distorted at various points. Powell did it in the 60s. He basically turned his back on the Empire and said, we don't need anybody but ourselves. We don't owe these people from the Commonwealth anything. They have no right to come here. You're seeing that again now, that we don't need immigration. We do. That we don't need to have contact with the outside world. We've got everything we need here. That sort of insularity is born out of a distorted version of a national story and deflating it and bringing it back down to earth so we can be proud of what we did in the Second World War, but not then see that as a sort of way of designing immigration policy for 2024 seems to me quite a good way of going about.
Is there, okay, so that's really interesting because you mentioned his earthiness and in the same way bringing these myths down to earth, right? So is this sort of a conscious effort to provide a kind of, maybe not ideological, but narrative blueprint, shall we say, for a Starmer government? Like, how much interplay is there between those two things?
I think it's almost inevitable because, you know, I was writing these books at the same time, you know, one with Mark and one on my own, but the sort of sense of the same theme of we need a slightly humble, less grandiose politics, which doesn't try and solve everything all at once with some three-word slogan, but tries to fix what we can fix, to try and find ways of making progress, not with the sort of straight lines of these big grandiose myths or these dividing lines we have in politics, but actually with ambiguity and nuance. You know, like, you know, I think Starmer at his best, I mean at his best, can sort of fit into the folds of the country, fit into the sort of the shape of the British people, better than some sort of big idea being imposed on them. It's like a sort of road system which goes round the hills rather than through them, like a common law, which is based on precedent and, you know, slowly forms a jurisprudence rather than some big Napoleonic principle. I think there's something potentially quite interesting about what Starmer could be as a politician. I don't think he's there yet. I mean, part of the problem is that he's surrounded by people sometimes who want him to be more like a traditional political leader. But I think if he relaxes in this role as a very English, very British person who happens to be a politician, he could actually get somewhere with this.
I mean, I think that's that, and that gets the causal direction exactly right, which is that, you know, we didn't set out to write a book as a sort of manual for what Keir Starmer should do.
Did you give him a copy? Here you are.
he has got a copy.
But more, I think that one of the reasons that he's been relatively successful, you know, at least in terms of opinion polling, is that he has managed to capture something that we were hearing from sort of completely diverse sources. You know, when we started the book, It was in the middle of the pandemic. I was living in Australia. We were having Zoom calls with people all over the country, you know, from the left and from the right, and old and young, and you know, successful and unsuccessful. And the picture we try and tell in the book about England emerged through all of those conversations, you know, about muddle and about everydayness and about not being too big and too grandiose and taking things at, you know, one step at a time. And I think that, you know, part of Keir Starmer's appeal has been his ability to reflect that back to the country. And so, you know, what political journalists or fellow politicians might see as a little bit boring or as a little bit flat, or you're not having enough kind of big vision behind it, is actually reflecting back to people, often at least, you know, what it is they currently feel and think about England. And that, I think, is, you know, testament to, you know, why he's been so politically successful. I mean, I always go back, he gave a speech, you know, Starmer gave a speech at party conference a couple of years ago where he uses this phrase, ordinary hope. And he says, like, you know, political leaders usually give you big, grandiose, utopian hope. He says, I can't do that. I'm not going to do that. But I'm going to focus on what I call ordinary hope, which is kind of everyday improvements delivered in a practical way. And it isn't big or flash or exciting, and it doesn't get sort of spontaneous standing ovation, but it is saying back to the country what we heard in all of those hundreds of Zoom calls we had, you know, in 2020.
Does that rise to the challenge of the scale of the crisis that he faced when he inherits Downing Street?
I mean, that's always the issue, I think. Yeah, totally. Which is that it's all well and good to, you know, talk about doing things slowly and being in the groove and working with ordinariness. But then when you are faced with like enormous economic, social, climate challenges, like, you've also obviously got to work at scale and at pace. So the other thing we try and do in the book is show that there are some extraordinary sort of activities going on around the country which have both of those qualities simultaneously. You know, Tom will tell you about the wind farms that he went to see in Plymouth, which are kind of rooted in the place, ideas which come from the local university, opportunities for Plymouth to reconnect with the sea, but also a real practical thing you can do about climate and helping us to get to net zero. And so, like, the hope is that the ordinary and the extraordinary can live together, and taking things seriously will make a difference.
You want to talk about wind farms, Tom?
These are actually floating wind farms. Mm. And if you think about Plymouth, which is really one of the places we base this sort of Drake maritime myth, you know, does our future really lie in building more aircraft carriers and going out to conquer and subjugate people beyond Europe? Or does it lie in trying to harness these elemental forces which are very much part of our story? We've always had a relationship with the wind and sea. We've got a very long coastline. We're really windy, right? We've always been out at sea. How can we use that story and use that history to meet the challenges of tomorrow? Now, floating wind farms are ugly. They're inelegant. They're uninspiring. But they have much more to say about what Britain's going to do and what England's going to do to deal with the existential problems about climate change or energy independence than building more warships or pretending we're global Britain.
Can I invite you as well to sort of talk about what I just asked Mark about there, about the kind of, I think the phrase that often now used is perma-crisis, right?
To describe polycrisis. This,
yes,
perma-crisis,
yeah, to describe the sort of state of Britain's existence. Mm. So in the face of that significant challenge, and whether it's an increasingly destabilized world now characterized by sort of regional geopolitical conflict, whether it's the increasing propensity for pandemics to come along, whether it's the degradation of our environment, these are existential issues, right? They're massive. And whether or not the kind of, to use the phrase that you guys have been using, muddle, or perhaps you might say managerialism or technocracy, perhaps, in your approach to dealing with problems of that scale, how do you see those two things interacting with each other?
So I think part of the polycrisis is populism, which is always sort of trying to find enemies, betrayal by some unseen hand of the establishment, a big radical idea to drain the swamp or leave Europe, or, you know, these big solutions aren't working for us. So I often, with Starmer, use a sort of metaphor. I don't quite know where it comes from, but it feels like we're at the bottom of a ravine at the moment.
And the way politics is set up is like, I am a big radical politician. And I have a radical plan to climb out of the ravine using only my teeth because no one has done that before. And that's what a radical politician will do. And the lobby sort of faint and go, isn't he amazing? As this, you know, person who tries to climb out, and his teeth are everywhere, there's blood everywhere, and there's gore, and he fails. Starmer will say, well, why don't we try a footpath?
Right.
And footpath's blocked. Okay, how do we get around a footpath? And it's like a sort of pragmatic radical. You know, he doesn't define himself in radicalism in as a radical in the first instance, but he takes successively more radical steps as are necessary in order to achieve a pragmatic goal. So, yeah, you know, you turn your back on this bloke who's trying to find a football because it's a much more interesting show with this bloke's teeth falling out. But, yeah, you know, you turn your back and he's halfway out of the ravine. And I think that, you know, the way to make progress is not to offer some impossible vision and actually make people more cynical about politics when it fails. Mm-hmm. It's actually to step by step, informed by values, informed by a sense of direction, try and work out how to fix things as far as we can.
And then the important challenge that it's not technocracy, I don't think, or managerialism, because it's not just about allowing politicians in Whitehall or Westminster to do this. I mean, what we're trying to say in the book is that, you know, these are kind of real, concrete, practical initiatives that are happening all over the country all the time, and nobody takes any notice of them because they're not big or flashy. They're not people, you know, climbing up the ravine with their teeth, and therefore they get ignored, and all the money goes off somewhere else. You know, we have a chapter in the book about Blackpool and efforts to sort of renew the economy in Blackpool. And there's these big flashy plans. They're called Silicon Sands, and they're going to be able to digitally connect Blackpool with North America so that there'll be surgeons in New York conducting, like, you know, brain tumor surgery in Blackpool hospitals. It's completely bonkers as far as we could tell. But a lot of excitement, a lot of money, a lot of flashy brochures, you know, and all the stuff which is actually going on in the ground to really make a difference to people's lives in Blackpool just get overlooked and ignored, and the money doesn't go there and the attention doesn't go there. And so I think what we're trying to say is, look, you know, ordinariness, muddle, confusion every day is in part just looking to find out where real solutions are happening and backing those people rather than sort of, you know, backing the big tech firms or privatized industries or sort of, you know, the fancy flash new idea which has come out of the public sector. People know how to sort these problems out. Let's learn from them.
And that's really important about Blackpool. You know, like, you know, Blackpool doesn't have a surplus of digital skills. What it has a surplus of is need. So why doesn't Blackpool invest in becoming one of the best places of caring for people with real need, rather than pretending it's going to create thousands of new jobs, you know, which are going to be far more expensive and probably won't happen?
Mm.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Total rhubarb. It's the politics show. Cast.
Yeah, I think this is one of the almost defining aspects of kind of austerity Britain, right, is this, the degradation of the social fabric and also the you know, the capacity of the state to be able to, well, do anything effectively. And so into that gap steps sort of third sector, you know, whether it's charities, just the local community, etc., that you now have, whether it's in Blackpool, it's happening all over the rest of the country, it's not just there by any means, that instead of there being an effective social safety net for people, that whether it is they need care, whether it is that they, you know, they're have severe disability and aren't able to work, and instead of the state saying, okay, we're going to look after you, we're now relying on kind of the good nature of their neighbours, which I don't actually think, whilst, you know, slightly sort of heartwarming to see people caring for each other, that there are people that still care for each other, isn't necessarily the best way, actually, of
totally
operating a functional society.
No, totally. And you're absolutely right that often these kind of community-based initiatives have come about because of, you know, dire need, which is the result of, you know, decades now of austerity. I think that's spot on. I think the thing, though, we're trying to say in the book is that it's not just that, that sometimes you can take, you know, like real steps forward by ideas and projects which are generated by local people who understand the challenges that are facing them. So they're not just responding to sort of dire need, which ought to be picked up and covered properly by central government, but they're actually coming up with new ideas. You know, I mean, one of the probably the stories that people know best, but in the book we talk about the vaccine during the pandemic and how Sarah Gilbert's lab it's not in the fancy bit of Oxford.
Yeah.
It's up in Headington in a sort of building that looks like a travel lodge. And, you know, her own academic career hasn't been sort of flash with lots of sort of, you know, plaudits and sort of long-term professorships. She's really had to struggle and fight for every little penny that she's been able to get. And it's through that kind of constant endeavour and constant desire to fight for better things in your own place that you're able to generate extraordinary outcomes, you know. Another hero in the book is Chris-Anne Jarrett, who founded an organization called We Belong to fight for undocumented migrants. Again, Chris-Anne is just an incredible story. It was one of the first interviews we did. You know, she was a kid at school when she realized she wasn't allowed to go to university because she didn't have settled status. And she thought, well, I'm not going to put up with that. But, you know, no one in Westminster is going to sort it out for me. I'm going to start an organization of people like me. We're going to campaign. We're going to fight. She got to the Supreme Court and she won. And she's now fighting again and again and again. And that is for us, I think, that's what's exciting. That's the pulse of England. And these aren't big myths. No one's going to tell her story or stick her on the front page of a newspaper. But it is the sort of the engine for real change.
Just a Chris-Anne story. But what I found so fascinating about that is it wasn't just, oh, you know, no one's going to sort it out for me in Westminster. I hate all these people. I'm going to go to a march. She actually used some of the stories about England to sort of climb up the sort of rusty ladder of the establishment. So, like, you know, she stood outside the Tory immigration minister's office with a sign saying, will you have a cup of tea with me? And a big pot of tea. And then when she went to see her, she brought a lemon drizzle cake. And in the end, she had everybody from Liam Fox to the Daily Telegraph supporting her campaign. Because she was using these old stories of England in a sort of deflated way to actually bring change rather than just rejecting them altogether. Mm. No, we don't want to destroy these stories about England. I think we want to find better ways of using them.
You also in the book describe the nation as an imagined community. And sort of the nation is imagined by people who perceive themselves to be part of a group. So, Mark, can I ask you to talk about that and also perhaps by way of who's in the group, who also is in the out-group.
Yeah, I mean, that's crucial, isn't it? I mean, like the challenge always, obviously, of something like England is it's so internally diverse and always has been. You know, like people used to say, oh, you know, with the waves of migration after the Second World War, you know, how are we going to stay together as a country? But they had said that before about relationships between working class people and non-working class people, or the North or the South, or industrial people or rural communities. So, you know, England has always been a diverse nation, and it holds itself together by telling particular kinds of stories and coming to particular kinds of identities. And again, one of the reasons we wanted to bring these big booming myths of the present down to earth a bit is so that it can include more people rather than fewer people. And we always said when we were writing the book that we wanted to tell a story about England that didn't belong to sort of any one group in particular. You know, it kind of belonged to everybody, or at least to, like, nobody could claim a sort of monopoly over it. And so it's by recognizing that diversity, that mix, that muddle, that plurality, that people have different things, they're from different places, they care about different values, but they still identify themselves as being from the same place. As a result, we hope, of sort of, you know, more ordinary, more everyday versions of English storytelling, that you can hold together the diversity, the difference, and this need we all have for solidarity, unity, and community, because everybody wants both, and that's what England ought to be able to provide.
Mm. And so in terms of the people that perhaps are defined as existing outside of that, how do you see, I'm thinking about sort of policy proposals at the moment, for example, kind of Rwanda plan heavily in quotation marks, and else as kind of demonizing aspects or people that exist in our society. Mm. How do you see that connecting to an imagined community of what England is?
So one of the places we went to was Wolverhampton, which was where Enoch Powell was MP for 30 years. And for a while, it seemed to be the sort of epicenter of what Powell imagined was going to be a sort of race war, battle for survival of English people. What's fascinating about it now is, you know, Wolverhampton Wanderers Football Club. And football's often been the vehicle for the most petty insular identities. I mean, why Wolves fans hate West Brom fans, I've never understood. They look like the same, they sound the same, they're only 10 miles apart. But, you know, intense rivalry, it still gets violent. Mm. But Wolves Football Club now has Punjabi Wolves sections where they bring their drums and, you know, you go outside the Wolves ground in Molineux and they're selling curries and dals. And the chapter begins with a young Sikh guy embracing an overweight white man for a brief moment of ecstasy, and then I sort of slowly reveal that they're at a football match together. The fact that people can come together with a shared identity, even though they are different, around institutions like football, ordinary things, not some sort of street theatre. Mm. This is like a football club which everybody identifies with in different ways, I think is part of the path to the future. It's about ordinary institutions where people all feel different kind of ownership of.
Mm. And so contrast that with the kind of Enoch Powell, Rivers of Blood type ideas / visions. And also, I would invite you to draw the connection between the kind of economic context at the time, right? And whether or not you believe there to be a connection between kind of economic downturns, boom and bust economics, and then a corresponding increase in sort of nationalist sentiment, nationalist feeling.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the places where people most resent immigrants are usually where there aren't any. Immigrants tend to go where jobs are. And where there aren't any jobs, generally don't get lots of immigrants. But people are told the reasons why they're poor, the reasons why things aren't working out, is because of immigrants. So, you know, I mean, it is a paradox, but, you know, and it's about this, the way that politicians are inflating myths about a particular sort of identity for sometimes very cynical, mendacious reasons. But it's not reflecting the reality. I mean, look, there are certainly places where there are pressure points when lots of new people arrive. It does change what your high street looks like. Not always for the worse, eventually. But, you know, you can see why people, you know, might resent that sometimes. I understand that. You know, there's ways of mitigating that and ensuring that where there's high immigration, there's extra investment to make sure that schools and hospitals are good. But we're not going to get functioning schools and hospitals without immigration. And so it's just telling different stories. Mm. Rather, yeah, you know, I think we went through a period where almost all political parties were cowed into this belief that immigration was a problem. Immigration was one of the reasons that this country was going wrong. And the really simple solution was to leave Europe and take back control of our borders. Well, how's that working out for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, I think that this is sort of belief that England can cut itself off from the rest of the world, and that sort of that is so rooted in so many of the myths that we talk about in the book. You know, the image of the White Cliffs of Dover, you know, England standing on its own in the Second World War, is then fueled this sense that, you know, the most important thing that we can do now is to secure our borders and turn back small boats and, you know, send people off to Rwanda. And it's a sort of it's the worst of the country in the sense that it's a kind of angry falsehood that we tell each other when we're feeling anxious as a nation. And you know, if the book's got one purpose, it's like to stop that kind of thing. Like, it's not true that we stood alone in the Second World War. We were dependent on all kinds of other people. And it's not true that you can deal with the mass migration issues of the 21st century by sort of cutting the rest of the world off and, like, having the Royal Navy patrol up and down the English Channel and then sending people off to some African country. It's just not true. And the reality of it is that people know this, and they know that that we're a complicated country and we're grappling with issues and it's going to be difficult. And as you say, like austerity, cost of living sometimes makes them feel more, you know, even more difficult than they otherwise are. But the only way that you become a, you know, proper, progressive, multi-ethnic, multicultural society is by looking at the reality of the world around you and telling stories which reflect it.
And the small boats thing is particularly interesting because, I mean, the number of asylum applications is actually lower than it was in the noughties. But it's this very visual image. It's like, you know, small boats in the channel. That's something about the Second World War, isn't it? And then, or maybe it's about the Armada. It's about being invaded. It's about the security of our, you know, the boundary that the channel's always represented. The solution to small boats crisis isn't jet skis or Royal Navy or Rwanda. It's something much more prosaic and boring and rather Starmerish, actually, which is supporting civil servants processing applications faster. Mm. You don't get headlines. There's no glamour in it, but it's actually the real solution.
Yeah, and possibly putting my processing centre over in Calais as well probably dissuaded a lot of people from crossing the channel.
And a bit of soft power in terms of negotiating returns agreements and things like this. But this is, you know, we're just addicted to these big radical plans. And, you know, climbing out of a ravine using only your teeth, rather than actually doing the practical thing, which will actually make things better.
Yeah. Should we talk about the flag, chaps?
We can.
Okay, so why do you think this has become a flashpoint? Well, I was going to say in recent times, but I mean, sort of St. George's Cross or the Union Jack, of they're always kind of there politically, right? The most recent iteration being about the England football team, right? And the adjustments that were made to the kit and the St. George's Cross there. Changes to the flag being a long-standing practice in sports teams' kits. I know that the Conservative Party has also changed a flag or two in its time.
So it's GB News.
Yes.
You know, they can spend all their time condemning change to the flag behind a backdrop, which is a distorted Union flag. I would say it's ridiculously weird, but they are. They are ridiculously weird.
Yeah, I mean, we've done some polling, you know, in the last few days to work out whether our book is in sync with what people really think or not. And, you know, one of the things that comes across really strongly in there is that, like, people don't have really strong views about the flag one way or the other. They're like, so, you know, we ask people, what do you think when you walk through a neighborhood which is flying lots of, you know, sort of across the St. George's? And we know that, you know, some people on the right will say that makes you feel really proud and sort of respectful, and other people on the left will sort of freak out and think this is xenophobic or sort of, you know, almost racist. But actually the vast majority of people don't think either of those things. You know, they probably think, you know, there might be a match on, or there may be something happening, that it's fine. It's absolutely fine. They're not against it. They're not that excited by it. It is just part of the backstory of the country. Mm. But there are these small pockets of people who have incredibly strong views, who, because of this addiction to puffed upness or climbing up ravines with your teeth, you know, they get all the coverage. And, like, you know, then you get a sort of apparent culture war about whether the flag is brilliant or awful. And that's just, like, not what England is.
So what's going on then? Is it just culture war? It is just, oh, we have an opportunity here to signal our either identity conservative position or identity liberal position. We are going to seize upon this so that we can have a political row. And in actual fact, the vast majority of people are just going, meh.
Yeah, I mean, there's a culture war in which most people aren't participating. But the culture war makes a lot of noise and it generates lots of headlines. And it's an explanation for bigger things. Look, the flag is quite literally a symbol. And I remember, you know, Euro 96 was the first time that I saw a lot of crosses of St. George's going up. And that was actually quite a liberal moment. You know, there was that song by Badil and Skinner, you know, which was all actually about coping with failure, you know, 30 years of hurt. And it was a really kind of, it became fashionable among everyone to have the cross of St. George. And as a symbol, I think it symbolizes something else as well about how we shouldn't let the right take all our stories, shouldn't let the right take all our symbols. Mm. I don't particularly care whether, you know, the left reclaims the Union flag or reclaims the cross of St. George. I do care that ideas of Englishness shouldn't just be the preserve of Nigel Farage and white racists. Mm. I think it's really important because I don't think we can come together as a country. I think what's happened with the England football team is brilliant, right? You know, England football team used to be a symbol of the worst divisiveness. You know, when John Barnes scored one of the greatest goals England ever scored at the Maracanã Stadium in, 1982? On the way back, National Front fans on the plane with the players were saying we only won 1-0 because the black players' goals didn't count. Now, England is seen as the England football team as something that brings the country together. You know, they take the knee and Tory politicians condemn them. I know which side I'm on.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's one of the sort of more peculiar things actually quite often in modern England is that really the only time that people feel English is when the football team is in a major tournament, basically. It's one of the few last remaining sort of communal English experiences that everyone in the country experiences. And I think your point from a sort of tactical political one is very relevant, right? Which is if you cede the territory, if you don't engage in a conversation about things like national symbol, national identity, you basically just create a vacuum in which your political opponents, most people's political opponents, are able to sort of fill it with the most kind of noxious and toxic political ideas. And instead, if you enter that territory, but you know, you sort of take, it's David Hume, I think, right? You can't eat a flag. That it's, yes, we are patriots. Our patriotism involves the criticism of our country because we love it and we want it to be better. But that rests on far more than the Union Jack.
Yeah, St. George's Cross. I mean, that's exactly right. And I mean, we had a lot of help with a book from the playwright James Graham, who wrote this play about the England football team called Dear England.
Did you see it?
Yeah. And I went to see it, and I was kind of bowled away by a scene very early on when the character playing Gareth Southgate, you know, the England manager, is saying to the team, you know, we've got the wrong story. You know, we're living with this story that England is somehow the best football team in the world because we won the World Cup in 1966, and everything else which has happened is kind of not, you know, not real or not false. And Southgate says it's just the wrong story. And then the players kind of look at him confused, and he said, we've got to tell a different story. So that we don't give up telling any stories. Like, we're still excited to play for England. We're still proud to play for England. But we can't live with that one anymore because it's not true. It's like overly inflated. And he thinks it's getting in their heads and making them too nervous to play proper football. So he says, like, let's bring the story down. Like, let's just say who we are, be proud of what we can do, but not have overly inflated expectations. And, you know, it was a great moment for me watching the play because that, again, is the kind of argument you're trying to say in the book, which is don't give up on England, don't hate England, like don't dismiss what it's done in the past, but recognise that it's, you know, it's not as grand as some of those other people want to tell you it is.
I think that's the thing, to continue the sort of England football team metaphor, which we will then spin out into a broader conversation about politics, which is that, yes, okay, this England team is now, in terms of actual footballing success, our most successful team since 66, right? Whether it's the Euros final, the World Cup semi-final. But actually, I don't think it is those results which has changed the way people feel about the team. It is the cultural shift that he's made. It's whether it's the letter he wrote to the country in the wake of Black Lives Matter or any of the other things, even if it's just as simple as, I don't know if you guys saw, there's that photo, I can't remember which tournament it was, where they're basically like all in a pool with like giant inflatable like unicorns and stuff dicking around. You cannot imagine like Wayne Rooney being like there in the pool, like splashing someone, right? Like the golden generation and the sort of macho attitude, right, that we've always previously associated with the team has kind of, to a certain extent, been washed away.
Yeah, it's great. I was at a Euro 2016 game with my son in France, England versus Wales. And that was taking place during the referendum. And the England fans, some of the England fans, were singing Brexit songs. It's also the day Joe Cox was murdered. And the change we've achieved in, you know, England football, which at that tournament we went out to Iceland, didn't we? I mean, that insularity, that failure, compared with this sort of open, expansionist, secure in who we are identity, I think that Southgate's given us. Yeah, he'll probably be sacked off the next tournament. Who knows? But I think
he'll quit regardless.
Yeah. But there's a I think it's as a, as another symbol, it shows where we can go. We're not saying we're the best. We're not saying that we can't learn from other people. Of course we can. We're saying that we're comfortable in an identity of a sort of messy identity of lots of differences. And in fact, those differences make us better rather than worse. And that's a huge lesson for where we go forward as a country.
Mm. We've sort of been talking about, alongside that, the kind of sort of inward-looking nature, right, of English nationalism, and perhaps that tends to be more divisive rather than unifying. New Labour tried to do something different to that, Mark. Could you talk about New Labour and national identity?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the book, we go to Greenwich and what was the Millennium Dome to kind of tell the story of New Labour and national identity, which was a sort of a desire really to get away from the question altogether because they realised it was difficult for them. So they paint this picture of a country of the future, which has left its past behind completely. You know, so there's no nostalgia anymore. There's no conservatism. There's no tradition. There's just globalisation and sort of shiny newness. That we argue in the book is as much of a myth as any of the others, which is that you can't have a country which has no stories about itself or doesn't have any connection to its past or doesn't have any sort of barnacles stuck onto it. It's just that's a kind of ideological falsehood. It's just not possible. And you see it in Greenwich and you see it in the Dome. So if you go and look at the Dome today, you know, it's sort of grey and sort of mildewy and sort of settled into its place. And, you know, it's not shiny or beautiful or fresh or new anymore, but it's still there. And people still interact with it and they still have experiences there and they still remember going, perhaps if they were kids and they went to the Dome. Lots of people who've read that chapter have told us about, you know, when they went on a school trip and they went around this kind of crazy thing. And I think our story there, you know, our kind of lesson to the New Labour folk, I guess, is like you can't wish away the country that you're trying to govern because it is the terrain in which you act. Doesn't mean you can't change it or want to change it or hope for a better future, but just pretending that there is no community or there is no place or belonging doesn't matter is not going to get you anywhere.
So what's the point of difference then, right, between that Labour Party and this one? Because the phrase you used there, wishing away the past, right, and I'd invite you to talk about that in the context of trying to kind of wash away the myths that you've spoken about here, because at the end of the day, they are, for better or for worse, they are there. So how do you see those two things interacting?
Yeah, I think in part, it's just a sort of desire not to be bombastic or utopian. I mean, that's the big argument of the book, really, which is that when we focus on what we're going to do with or for or with the country as a politician, for example, then you've got to start from where you're at, even if you're then trying to move it forward. And that is a mess. You know, there's lots of great stuff you can use in England, and there's lots of really terrible stuff which gets in the way and slows everything down. But sort of beginning with clear-eyed assessment of actually what the situation is just the sort of precondition for any kind of success. That's the argument. And I think that's what we see in the best of politics at the moment that you didn't see back in the past. You know, I mean, I was always amazed, for example, on Brexit. Take Brexit as an example. I've got friends who were sort of Labour pro-Brexiteers. And it just always seemed like a complete utopian fantasy that, like, with one act, you know, take back control, or, you know, you could press a button and all the bad stuff will suddenly disappear. And then before you know it, you're going to, you know, propel yourself into a socialist future. It was not going to happen because that's not how change occurs. And in fact, it leads you to do some really stupid things. So, you know, so taking off those rose-colored spectacles or whatever the right metaphor is and looking with a sort of unsparing gaze at reality seems to be the precondition for any kind of social improvement.
Yeah, I mean, to answer your question about what's the difference, again, at its best, I think the current Labour Party more reflects like the Olympic opening ceremony, which was messy. It told lots of stories. Not one dominant story, but lots of stories, compared to the Millennium Dome's opening ceremony, which was abstract and vacuous. And I think if you can somehow reconnect with reality, with real people, with that real country that I think lies behind these myths, I think Labour could become a party that's in power for quite a long time, particularly as the Conservative Party seems to be going off into the marshlands of the sort of batshit crazy sort of place where they, you know, doesn't bear any relationship to what ordinary people think. I mean, you know, 80,000 people dressed in a mixture of tweed and latex who elected Liz Truss do not look like this country. Mm. I think Labour's beginning to look more like this country and reflecting the ambiguities, reflecting the nuances which actually go with any real place.
I think that's the concern for me, basically, is what you've spoken about there, the kind of what modern Britain looks like now, and combining that with what you were saying earlier about ordinary hope, right? Is that the kind of the status quo, or what is now ordinary in Britain, for an entire generation of people, for younger people, for example, when we talk about whatever it is, the way that their inability to essentially afford a house and whether or not they will ever be able to get one without their parents dying and them inheriting money, the fundamental breach of what is essentially the social contract that we say as a generation to our successors, we are going to hand down a country to you in a better state than the one that we inherited in. There's this idea of permanent social progress, right? And I think about younger people, the lot that they are inheriting, whether it's insecure housing and insecure job market, and they'll hear a phrase like ordinary hope and say, I don't fucking want ordinary and I don't have any hope, you know?
Well, I think there's a lot of cynicism about politics, particularly among young people, and people think they're all the same. But if you do get a new set of workers' rights, which I think Labour are going to do partly because it doesn't cost money, that'll make a difference. Mm. That will make a difference to their daily environment, going to work in a gig economy without rights. If Labour does build 1.5 million new homes, that's going to make a difference. Mm. And the idea that there's no differences between parties is for the birds. I mean, now, you can't solve everything, but if you can begin to show that politics can make a difference to people's lives, that will feel like a transformation compared to what we've had over recent decades.
I mean, I would add that I don't think it stops or starts with professional formal politics, and that again is one of the key themes of the book, that trying to get back that sense of hope and aspiration is already beginning. And you know, one of the reasons I find the ordinary hope idea exciting is because people who look as if they are very ordinary are already giving us hope. You know, and that's the Chris Ann Jarrett story that we talked about earlier on. You know, being able to transform the lives of people who are in incredibly difficult circumstances here through hard work and, you know, proper campaigning, that's transformative. And like, so whatever happens in professional politics, whatever goes on in Westminster, there is a sense, I think, that you can draw the best of the country forward and, you know, begin to tackle the problems that you completely rightly identified. I mean, they are the things that are going on. But across the country, people are doing things about them, often in incredibly difficult circumstances, and they deserve some attention.
Mm. We're at the end of our time together, chaps. So, England, 7 myths that changed the country and how to set them straight. It's out this week, I do believe.
Yep. It's the same week as St. George's Day. So,
yeah. It's almost as if it was planned like that. Thank you for coming in. I really enjoyed the conversation. Really appreciate it. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.